Hey everyone, welcome back to another episode of Curious Katie-O, where this season we are diving into all things that I'm curious about related to reading, books, and ideas behind them. I'm your host Katie, and today we'll be diving into a book that to me is a really interesting game changer. It's a book by Adam Grant called Originals. So whether you're a seasoned entrepreneur or a creative person or someone who wants to make a difference, you know, this book is really a key for you. But what exactly makes someone original? So what I want to do is go through some of the big misconceptions about originality and talk about really five key findings that I had from this book. So let's jump into it. The first thing is that originals aren't necessarily risk takers. You know, that was one of the most surprising insights from the book, is that being original doesn't mean you have to be some wild risk taker. In fact, Adam Grant, you know, makes it really clear that many of the most successful originals are actually risk averse in certain areas in their life. They kind of hedge their bets. So he talks a lot about the example from the founders of Warby Parker. If you haven't used Warby Parker, I've been using them for years. It's a company that really changed the way that you do eyeglasses. And this last year was the first time my husband actually did it too. When they started their business, and what their business is you go online, you pick frames that you like, they send them to your house, you get to try them on, and then you pick the one that you like, and then they call your doctor and do your prescription and order it for you. And it's really nice because you're not in this confined retail space having to look at frames and see if the person across from you who you met, you know, 5 minutes ago is going to tell you, hey, you look great or not. The idea was you can take your time and try them on and wear them for a bit and wear them doing different activities and just really see what works for you. So really game changing in terms of the way that they took an industry like eyewear and changed the way that you approached it. And so Adam originally was approached to be a founder in it and said no. But one of the things is when they started their business, they didn't just jump in. They didn't quit their day jobs. They actually kept their jobs while they were working on the startup. And so Adam was, you know, one of the early advisors because he had known the two that started the company. And he admits that he got it totally wrong about founders. He thought that the founders that went the farthest should totally commit to their startup, quit everything you're doing, go all in. And he was surprised that they took a more cautious approach to it. And so reflecting on this in the book, here's a quote that he had that I really liked. I thought it was a huge mistake to not go all in, but I was wrong. They showed me that you can be cautious in your approach and still succeed. So I think this insight really challenges the common misconception that originality or to be an original is all about being bold and all in and these huge gambles. And instead, it's about managing risk in a smart way and knowing when to play it safe. You know, think about this phrase, side hustles, and things that people keep exploring in their spare time that eventually become full time. One of my favorite entrepreneurs, Sarah Blakely, started selling Spanx while she was actually working in sales, and she would fit that in around her day job. And there's tons of these stories. So what does that tell me? You know, if I'm sitting here reading this book, just because you can't do it full time doesn't mean it's not worth exploring or trying. So think about that thing that you might want to try, and you trying it and dedicating certain periods of time each day to it might get you the bigger opportunity like a Warby Parker or a Spanx. The second thing is that procrastination can really be helpful to entrepreneurs and individuals. So that was a big eye-opener for Adam because he is not a procrastinator. He seems like a super organized person. But he challenges this idea that procrastination, which is often viewed as a bad habit, can actually foster creativity and lead to better outcomes. So, you know, how many of you would consider yourselves procrastinators, right? For me, it depends on what the task is. If it's a task I really like, I can jump into it at any point and totally do it and do it way ahead of time. But tasks that maybe I don't want to get into or I haven't figured out a good solution yet, I'll do a piece of it and then I'll procrastinate until maybe like a week before or sometimes a couple days before to wrap it up. And so for many of us, he talks about procrastination and it carries this really negative connotation, like you're wasting time or you're lazy. But Adam really challenges this by showing us this idea of strategic procrastination. Any student, you can use that with your teacher. I'm not lazy. I'm strategically procrastinating. But it can actually enhance your creativity and speed up your success in the long run. So let's talk about what some of the examples are that he gave. So the first is he shares the story of Martin Luther King Jr., who famously procrastinated in reading and writing his I Have a Dream speech until the last moment. And the delay he talks about wasn't due to a lack of discipline, but it was this deliberate choice that allowed him to absorb new ideas and adapt it to the evolving context of the movement that he was leading. So it's this idea that I have this idea, but I'm also going to take the time to look at what ideas are out there, what new ideas, how I might adapt things slightly based on what's going on. And even the line, I have a dream, was one that he put in near the last minute. So the result was a speech that really connected and has become one of the most powerful moments in history. But because he delayed and really wanted to absorb the moment of what he was seeing into that talk. And so Grant explains in the book, this is a great quote, procrastination gives you time to consider divergent ideas, to think in non-linear ways, and to make unexpected leaps. So what does that mean? In other words, you know, when we delay a task, our minds continue to work on it in the background. You know, how many of you have a commute where you use that time to think about things, either heading into the office or heading home? There's the, you know, quintessential, I got the idea in the shower kind of thing. It's this idea that when you're unplugged, it's not that your brain completely unplugs, you're still thinking about the ideas. And in doing that, you might put pieces together you didn't realize before and can think of an idea in a new way. So think of an idea where you had, you know, just something you were working on, something you were thinking about. And when you sat with it for a while and dissected it from a bunch of different angles, you ended up actually coming to a completely different solution than what you thought you were going to do initially. This concept ties into some of the experiences that Steve Jobs had, who was really known for being strategic in delaying product development in particular. One of the quotes from the book is, Steve Jobs delayed decisions until the last possible moment to allow for more input and creativity. This delay ultimately sped up the process as the time spent thinking up front reduced the need for extensive revisions later. How many of you have worked in, you know, product development or things like that where you end up doing so many revisions because you didn't necessarily take the time to think through up front before you locked into something? You know, the other example he gives is Leonardo da Vinci, whose biography I've read, talks about him being a notorious procrastinator to explore a lot of ideas. And one of those ideas was ultimately the Mona Lisa. So here's his quote from the book. Da Vinci's endless curiosity and his willingness to let ideas marinate over time led to some of the greatest works of art in history. He wasn't just delaying, he was thinking deeply, and that made all the difference. So if you've read the Leonardo da Vinci book by Walter Isaacson, it's a thick book, so just be aware if you're going to dive into it. He didn't do that many pieces of art, which I think really surprised me when I read it. I thought he would have like a catalog of art, and he didn't. He spent time working on things, and he'd put it down, and he'd pick it up, and he'd work on it again. And that time to rethink the work that he was doing or challenge what he thought was good before is what led to his greatness and his legacy that he's left. So this idea of thoughtful procrastination is something we can all apply. You know, instead of rushing to complete a task just to check them off your list, think about allowing yourself space to think and explore different ideas and refine those ideas, and use that thinking time to really challenge what your initial idea was. And here's another quote from the book that he has. By taking our time, we often end up getting it right the first time, rather than having to go back and fix mistakes later. You know, for me, the best example I can give you is when I have to do a presentation. What I do is I come up with an outline and I come up with a rough idea of what are the things I think I'm going to present. And usually I know well in advance that these are coming. So sometimes for 30 or even 60 days, I just let it sit. And I'm usually thinking about things, or if I get an idea, I'm going through stuff like, oh, I should include that, or that's a good example, or I think that might be funny. I scribble it down, but I really wait and usually come back and end up changing almost the whole thing because I've been thinking about it differently or how I want to approach it. So what are the things that you're doing that you're just kind of running through and checking the box versus taking the time to put something together and then pause and think on it and then come back? So the next time you find yourself really delaying a task, don't be too hard on yourself. That delay might just be a really cool, you know, almost secret ingredient to some of your brilliant ideas, and it might actually help you in the long term. The third big concept from the book was the power of doubt. So Adam talks a lot about how doubt is often seen as a weakness and something that holds us from taking action. But in the book, the originals, he really flips this idea on its head, showing that doubt, when you harness it correctly, can be a powerful tool for innovation and success. So he makes an important distinction between self-doubt and idea doubt. And this distinction is really critical for anyone looking at this. So let's go into each of those. So self-doubt can be paralyzing. It's that inner voice that's like screaming in your ear, I'm not good enough, I can't do this, why are you even trying? And this idea that can stop you from taking that first step. However, idea doubt is super different. So idea doubt is the questioning of your ideas, not your abilities. And it's really what drives you to refine, improve, or ultimately create something new. So he illustrates this with the story of the Wright brothers, who doubted every step of their journey to inventing the first successful airplane. You know, they were constantly revising their designs, questioning their assumptions, testing their approaches. They doubted their ideas. They doubted whether they could lead to some, you know, groundbreaking achievement in aviation. And here's what he writes in the book. The Wright brothers succeeded not because they were fearless, but because they were relentless in their pursuit of improvement, constantly doubting and refining their ideas. You know, so in fact, you know, he argues that the most successful originals are often those who fail the most. And it's because they're the ones who are constantly testing and iterating on their ideas. And here's a quote that he has. The greatest originals are the ones who fail most because they're the ones who try the most. This perspective can be a big reminder that doubt and failure are not necessarily enemies, but they're just part of the creative process. And he talks about this idea of doing postmortems. It's a strategy that some companies use, some don't. And what it is it really is a way to anticipate and address failures before they happen. So instead of waiting for something to go wrong, they preactively kind of doubt their idea and identify all the potential pitfalls. So here's a quote where he says, a premortem is an exercise in harnessing doubt. By imagining all the ways an idea could fail, you can strengthen it before it's even begun. So this approach can prevent costly mistakes. It can lead to more robust innovations. It's a way for you to get ahead of things that may be a problem downstream because you're thinking of yourself as your competitor or somebody else in the market. And how would you go after it if you came out with this? And even Steve Jobs, you know, was not immune to doubt. So he talks about how Jobs would frequently second-guess product ideas, sometimes to the frustration of his team. But this doubt wasn't about his ability to lead. It was about making sure they got the product right. So here's a quote that he has. Jobs' doubt wasn't a sign of weakness. It was a sign of strength that drove him to push his team to create products that were truly groundbreaking. So he points out that, you know, doubt can be a sign of caring deeply about your work. When you're invested in an idea, it's natural to question it. Think about it. How do I improve it? And this reframing of it is very liberating. It tells us that it's okay and even necessary to question our ideas. It's this questioning of whatever concept you're coming up with that can lead to breakthroughs and innovations and original thinking. And he concludes this section talking about, here's the quote, doubt is not the enemy of originality, complacency is. So the next time you're coming up with an idea, remember, doubting the idea and thinking of ways that you might approach it differently is part of the creative process. And you can use that doubt to fuel your originality, your ideas, and potentially create something truly differentiating. The next thing he talks about is groupthink is the enemy of originality. So how many people have worked on group projects and remember those from school? You're going to want to keep that in mind as we go through this process. So Adam Grant talks a lot about groupthink, and it's this tendency for a group to conform to a single viewpoint, often at the expense of being truly creative and innovative. So groupthink can stifle originality, it can mean that companies and people make poor decisions. And he argues that if you foster a culture where dissent is encouraged and different perspectives are valued, it's crucial for cultivating original ideas. Groupthink is not collaboration. It's more of a go along to get along versus a series of sharing thoughts and ideas. So one of the most powerful examples he gave discusses the Challenger space shuttle disaster. And I don't know if you've seen this. There's a series of this online. It is a great and somewhat really sad way that the NASA Challenger space shuttle disaster happened. And anybody that grew up in the 80s as a kid remembers that. And it really focuses on this idea that there were moments along the way it could have been prevented, but nobody spoke up and nobody listened to those that spoke up. So it occurred in part because of groupthink among engineers and decision makers. You know, concerns were raised by some of the engineers about the O-ring's performance in cold temperatures. They had examples of that over time and where it was wearing and the problems that they were having. But the dominant opinion within the group was to proceed with the launch. And this conformity to the majority view, despite valid opinions to the contrary, is what led to one of the most catastrophic failures. So here's how Grant talks about it. Here's his quote. When a group prioritizes harmony and consensus over critical thinking, the results can be disastrous. The failure to voice and consider dissenting opinions led to the Challenger disaster, a stark reminder of the dangers of groupthink. And if you watch the miniseries, it's actually really cool. Not in a good way, but it was really cool because they had a group where all of the experts were in the room and they were talking about how they shouldn't launch. And then they had a separate side meeting, kind of kicked a bunch of them out and brought them back and said, yeah, we're going to kick you out. And the leaders who were at the time the least knowledgeable of what was actually going on made a decision without the experts in the room, the experts that would have said, we don't think you should go. And so it's a really good testament of even some of the smartest people at some of the biggest companies, when they take this approach of being blinded to what's actually in front of them, it can be disastrous. So what about, you know, in the workplace, or what about everyday lives? You know, Grant really emphasizes the importance of creating environments where people feel safe to express their ideas, even when they challenge the status quo. And here's his quote. Leaders who surround themselves with yes men are setting themselves up for failure. True originality comes from fostering a culture where diverse perspectives are not only welcomed, but actually sought out. You know, for me, I always laugh. I try to cultivate a team, and my team does this as well, where you have people next to you and around you that are very different than you. And my joke is often this. I know what I think. I don't need to have more people tell me what I think and echo what I think. I need to know what you think. And so Grant talks about the dangers of groupthink and the value of dissent early in his career. He recounts a time when he was advising a company on their hiring practice. And the company had a strong culture of promoting from within and was really resistant to outside hires. And initially, Grant went along with the consensus. He began to doubt, you know, this approach. And here's his quote. I started to wonder if we were missing out on fresh perspectives by always promoting from within. My doubt grew, but I was hesitant to voice it, fearing it would disrupt the group's harmony. So eventually he did speak up, and his doubts led to the company reevaluating their hiring strategy. And they began to bring in external candidates with different experiences, which ultimately enriched the company's culture, provided new innovation. And when he reflects back on this, this is his quote from the book, it was a valuable lesson for me. Conformity might feel comfortable in the moment, but it's often at odds with the pursuit of originality. It takes courage to voice dissent, but that's where true innovation begins. And he points out that self-doubt can be a powerful antidote to groupthink. You know, when you doubt your own ideas, you're more likely to seek out alternative viewpoints, and you're more likely to be open to feedback. So this kind of, what he calls it, intellectual humility, which I liked, can prevent the confidence that comes with folks that have this idea of groupthink. And so here's what he talks about. Self-doubt is what led me to challenge the consensus and propose a different hiring strategy. It wasn't easy, but it opened the door to more creative and effective solutions. And one of the really good examples he gave of how to avoid groupthink that led to really great success is the story of Pixar. So the animation studio is really known for its brain trust meetings, where directors present their work to a group of peers who are encouraged to critique it openly and honestly. And this culture has led to some of the most awesome films of all time, like Toy Story and Finding Nemo. And here's this quote. Pixar's success is built on the belief that the best idea comes from rigorous debate and diverse perspectives, not from a single dominant voice. So I remember a time I was in a meeting and I was talking to a leader after the meeting and after I decided to leave the company, and he was asking for some feedback. And, you know, here's what I shared with him. I said, you're a consensus thinker and a leader. And so what that means is sometimes in a room of 10 people, the two who want to do something differently are the right ones, and the eight that want to go along with something else aren't. And this idea that if you continue to follow majority rules and the motivations of the eight are always the ones that you go with, you might never have truly original or new ideas. Because if you're looking for consensus or you're looking for conformity, the two who want to do something different are seen as outliers versus the eight who kind of want to keep the status quo. While it might feel comfortable, might limit your ability to think differently. And so one thing to think about with groupthink, it's super comfortable and safe, but it really often comes at the cost of creativity or innovation. And so when you have environments where you encourage dissent, where self-doubt is a strength, you know, where you have diverse perspectives and you're challenging your own ideas, that's really where you unlock this originality. The last concept that he had, which I really liked, is that the most empowering message of the whole thing is that originality is not an inane trait. It's not something you're born with. It's something you can cultivate. This idea is in huge contrast to what most of the myths are, that certain people are born creative or born bold or born to be original. You know, historically, there's been this widespread belief that creativity and originality are these gifts that a few lucky people have, this belief that it's rooted in these geniuses, the idea that, you know, people like Einstein or Mozart were simply born with these talents that set them apart. And it's been perpetrated through the stories that people tell and the early brilliance and, you know, emphasizing their ability of hard work and learning and what that took. But what he does is he challenges this idea by pointing out that focusing solely on innate talent overlooks the significant role that effort, environment, and mindset play in fostering originality. And he says that the myth of this being born a genius can actually be harmful because it discourages people from pursuing their own creative potential. Here's his quote that he says, "When we believe that originality is something you either have or you don't, we give up too soon. We forget that creativity is a skill that can be developed." And he shares a bunch of examples about this. He illustrates how ordinary people have cultivated originality through persistence. And one is the story of Thomas Edison, who is celebrated for his invention of the light bulb. But what's common and known is the light bulb. What's less common is the fact that he had over 1,000 patents, many of which were ideas that never worked. And he talks about it was Edison's volume of work, his willingness to experiment and fail, that led to his most significant breakthroughs. Here's this quote. "Edison wasn't born with the gift for invention. He became one of history's greatest inventors through relentless trial and error." He also talks about being, you know, original and challenging the status quo and being open to new experiences. And this idea he talks about with Albert Einstein. I don't know if you've read Einstein's biography. That's another one by Walter Isaacson. That's a big book if you want to read it. Really interesting, really flawed person that did some great things. And he's portrayed as this like natural genius. But what he really highlights is this idea, he was really just challenging norms. And he famously questioned the prevailing views on space and time, leading to his theory of relativity. So the quote from the book is, "Einstein wasn't just a genius, he was someone who refused to accept the world as it was and dared to see it differently." And so, you know, he challenged a lot of things in the book, and even though he was a bit of a horrible human, you know, he really thought differently. And the funny part about the book is that near the end of his life, people started challenging his theory of relativity, and he became the establishment because he couldn't understand why people would challenge that idea. So he went from being this innovator and groundbreaker to almost becoming like the establishment, that people were now challenging him. It's a really interesting perspective on his life if you want to read it. He also shares a story of Seinfeld creator Larry David, who really changed the way, you know, comedy looked from conventional rules of what, you know, Seinfeld or Curb Your Enthusiasm or how these situational comedies were based, and the idea that it was based on nothing. And so here's a quote that he had from the book around Larry David. So he said, Larry David wasn't born with a script for how to change TV comedy. He developed it by questioning the traditional format and experimenting with new ideas. And so if you've ever watched either of those series, you know, people often comment that the reason why Seinfeld's work afterwards hasn't really taken off to the degree that Larry David's has is because the creation of Seinfeld was really Larry David's creation. And this idea that he was willing to challenge ideas and challenge the way that people look at comedy and TV and what that approach is. You know, Adam Grant also discovered that this process of becoming an original involves a lot of failure, experimentation, and persistence. And this is in direct opposition to these myths around, like, oh, it's effortless, you know, an effortless production of these ideas. And here's what he talks about. What separates the originals from the rest is not a natural gift, but the grit to keep going in the face of obstacles and the curiosity to keep exploring new possibilities. So in a culture for some kids today, the drive of perfection and fear of failure may actually hinder them long term with their success, because failure and experimentation and continuing to keep going is a big piece of creating something totally different. And he also talks about how the environment can play a significant role in creativity. So if you surround yourself with diverse perspectives, if you grew up in an environment where you seek out feedback and being open to new experiences, those can all help you develop your skills that you need to be original. So the next time you doubt your creative potential, remember, originals are made. Nope, that's not true. Originals are made, not born. So think about that. It's not something you're born with. It's something you can make yourself into. And with the right mindset and approach, you can cultivate these skills. So you may be wondering why he wrote this book and what does he want us to take away from it. So Adam Grant is an organizational psychologist who spent his career studying how people can bring their best ideas to life. And he really wrote this to challenge the conventional wisdom about creativity and show that anyone in any field can make a unique impact. In his interviews, he often emphasizes that he wants readers to see originality as accessible to everyone. And here's a quote that he's used. The world needs more people who are willing to speak up and take action on their ideas, not just the ones who have the loudest voices or the most resources. And to me, this message really resonates, especially in a world where we're often told to fit in or follow the rules, or that conformity can be kind, all of those types of things. It's this idea that there's a process to think about being creative in a way that's not hostile and it's not aggressive, but it is persistent. And it is one where if you challenge your own thinking, you might come up with ideas that no one ever has. So thanks for joining me on this episode of Curious KDO. And if you haven't read the originals yet, I hope that this podcast gives you a take of just what kind of compelling book it is. It's a different way of thinking. It's full of a bunch of insights, really great stories, and advice that you can actually apply in your own life, whether you're looking to innovate at work, or you want to start a new project or a side hustle, or you just want to think differently about things that you're doing. So if you enjoyed this episode, be sure to subscribe, leave a review, or share it with your friends. And as always, stay curious.